So we're sitting down today with Sean Sullivan. Those of you that are familiar with Sean probably recognize him as Sully. He, as he describes, he's a guy with a story, and it's a lengthy story that we can probably turn into chapters. There's a lot of things that Sully has done. There's a lot of things that he still does that I think provide value to everybody, whether you're a small business owner, an entrepreneur, a manager, executive, or what have you. This podcast is brought to you by smallbusinesstogrow.com. A guy with a story. Give us like the condensed version, right?
Oh, as my wife says, there are no Sully condensed stories. So just a quick rundown. I started off as the only child of a single parent who had a lot of substance abuse problems, but she was a great person. She was very successful in her career. And I hit a moment in my life where I had a epiphany, if you can have one as a 13-year-old, or realization that there are two different kinds of mindsets. Actually, there's three kinds of mindsets. You know, everybody always hears about the victim and, you know, the survivor mentality. Well, I started to embrace a third mindset, and it was the warrior mentality. And a warrior will attack. They will move forward. Sometimes a warrior may need to retreat or make a tactical decision or move laterally or do whatever, but there is always that warrior ethos. There's always that propel yourself to move forward. Do not let your circumstances dictate the outcome of anything. And, you know, be prepared and do battle and move forward. And I just kind of embraced that warrior ethos with meeting Arnold Schwarzenegger as a 13-year-old kid. And I fell in love with bodybuilding at that time, which is one of my passions, mostly because of his aura, his ability to draw people in, his confidence. He knew his why. He knew what he was going to do in his life. He might not know, you know, what it was going to be in, but he knew that there was going to be a success, and he was successful in multiple facets. And that became my fascination. And then I just started following my other purposes and started outlining things for myself. I think I started trying to develop myself at a young age, and it was never because I wanted to succeed in anything. Money was never, ever, ever a motivator for me. My wife often, you know, jokes with me that, you know, had I been monetarily motivated, I probably could have owned Amazon or something like that. But it was always to develop self. It was always to go to the next level of development within myself, and then successes came. And I had some great successes in the law enforcement arena, in bodybuilding, and in the military, and have just really just had a wealth of great experiences with all three.
Let's take those apart, because I think that's gonna demonstrate and show you like why you have the skills that you do. So just bodybuilding, how many contests did you do?
Oh, probably about 120, 130.
So we have a competitor that's competed north of 100 times. That's significant. Let's look at the military piece.
Marines. Yep, Marines, Army, and Air Force.
Okay. And so Marines as a young man, as an 18-year-old enlisted.
Started off in the Marine Corps. I enlisted when I was of legal age to enlist. I believe it was 17. And just a quick funny story about that. my mom, who had been an officer in the Air Force, had me all set up to go into the Navy. So I actually touched three branches of the service. So I was actually enlisted, but not sworn into the Navy. I was going to be a nuclear submarine reactor technician. And my recruiter wasn't there one day when I went to visit him. So the Marine Corps recruiter was there. And he said, "Hey, let's go drop some quarters at the arcade." We did that. And he said, "Hey, let's go to McDonald's and have lunch." So we did that. And then he said, "Hey, let's go watch some really cool videos of Marine doing Marine Corps shit in my office." Needless to say, the next day he and I drove in, I swore in as a Marine. So technically I touched all four branches, excluding Space Force and Coast Guard. But yeah, so I always like to tell that story. That kind of set the wheels in motion.
So,
I'm sorry, you broke out.
how many years were you in the Marine Corps?
4 years, and I extended for another deployment. So 4.5 years of actual service time in the Marine Corps, but 4 years and
And
eight
then,
months.
so then from there, and that was active duty enlisted, correct?
Correct.
And then you went to the Army.
Yes, sir.
And was that active duty enlisted, or was that reserve or guard?
Combination of both. I had the only reason I'd gotten out of the Marine Corps is because I was encouraged to continue my education. When I was in the Marines, I was doing a lot of this was before we had all the online courses. I loved going on deployments. It wasn't quite as intense back. This is during the Cold War. So most of our deployments were floating around on boats and then pretending to attack islands and going around and doing fun stuff. But when you were on the boat, they had college courses that they would offer you. And I realized that I wanted to continue that aspect of my education. So I started taking a lot of college courses. And then when we got back into Garrison, I was at Camp Pendleton in California. They would do satellite courses that you can take here and there, you know, the old, you know, brick and mortar building with a professor and the paper and the whole thing. And the officer corps realized that, you know, what I was trying to do. And so they suggested that I didn't qualify for any of the commissioning programs. I didn't have enough education. There was just so much going on and didn't have the income to, you know, go to, or connections to go to Annapolis or one of the academies. So they suggested, hey, why don't you pop out and finish off your degree, come back in as an officer. And I did, and I wasn't out. I was on my I was on my terminal leave, and I ran into an Army recruiter who was like, "Well, crap, you know, join the National Guard, and we'll pay for your schooling, 100% of your tuition. And oh, by the way, we can commission you with an associate's degree, and then you have to finish the rest of your degree in 2 years." And went through all that, and so I started in the Guard, and then through my 12 years in the Army, I spent time in the Guard, active duty, and then back into the Guard.
So then did you commission as an officer in the Army then?
I did, yes.
What rank?
I made it to the rank of captain, and that's when I took a break in service of about 8 years before I decided to go back in. But that had to do with just all the other factors. I had a family, a child. I was on the police department, SWAT team guy. There was just too many irons in the fire. And any of the National Guardsmen out there who were commissioned officers will realize exactly what I'm talking about. There comes a time in your military, when you're Guard or Reserve, there comes a point where you need to make a decision, and that's whether you're just going to be a Guardsman and you kind of miss a lot of opportunities, or you're going to do what they call AGR, Active Guard Service. So it's kind of like full time, but in a Guard. And that gives you the development that you need to excel and, you know, try to be a general one day. And I realized being a full-time police officer and trying to do, I was a pilot at the time. So trying to get all my flight time in, I was a commander. So trying to command my troops, then trying to be a father, that there was just too much. So I took a break in service, and that's why I stepped out.
And then after that break, you went to the Air Force.
Yeah, it was about an 8 year break in service. 9/11 came and went, and things were still happening. So that was a big motivator. But the primary motivator for me was the loss that I felt. There was just something about being in the military, something about the warrior culture, the ethos, just the, there was something there that was just such a big part of me. And I had felt the loss for 8 years, and then I was out, and I decided to give another branch of the service a try. So I went Air Force, but I went back in enlisted. So yeah, I got one of those crazy stories where I was an enlisted, made it to be a non-commissioned officer, got a commission, went through my officer, through the officer ranks, came back in again as a non-commissioned officer, and then spent the next almost 18, 20 years, I don't know, long time in the Air Force, long time.
So you had more than 15 years in the Air Force.
Yes. Yeah, 15, I think it was 16 Air Force, 12 Army, and just under 5 Marines.
So in the reason I'm kind of pulling that piece of your story into the conversation is you have over 30 years of experience in the military. And when we look at, business operations, or it could be running a school, it could be running a sports organization, it could be what you currently do with the OCB physique bodybuilding organization. In the military, you're dealing with not capital in terms of dollars and cents, you're dealing with humans. Like quite literally, and that's in times of conflict, that the cost could be human life. It could be capital equipment, which a business would have, which a little league would have. But also, we're talking that, you know, expense can mean the loss of life. And the reason that matters is you have 30 years of some of the best coaching, training, mentoring, education, leadership programs on the planet for how to be good at leading, working with individuals, and building teams. So that's, you know, I think that 30 years is darn near priceless. And then somewhere within that, how long were you a police officer?
24 years.
So within all of that military experience, and some of it, you were juggling quite a bit as an officer in the Guard or the Army, and then doing full-time police work.
Yes. Yeah. It was, it became challenging, doing the two, but at a certain point, I realized how each one made me better at the other. Being a police officer made me a better military leader, and being a military leader made me a better police officer. And by taking skill sets I was developing in both, it made me a better human being.
Nice. Now, from a leadership standpoint, I spoke to you like 2 years ago, by I think it was maybe more than that, and I think it was like a Thursday or a Friday, and you're like, I got some time right now, but I've got two guys and I don't know where they were going, but they were going to a school, or they were moving on from where you were in the military, and they were going to be doing some physical training for the weekend. And you're like, yeah, so I'm going to go and do the entire training with them.
Yeah. It was
the
German Armed Forces military proficiency badge. Yeah. Yeah. It's a big, big athletic badging competition. And I would do it every year with my people.
But I think in a nutshell that's why, or that's how an individual arrives at an effective leader, is you're on the ground, you're in the dirt, you're doing the same thing that the others are, regardless of your rank or your position. That's, you know, if you own and operate a factory, that means you're on the shop floor, you're helping on an assembly line as needed. And it's not a matter of, I'm too good for that, I got dress clothes on and you don't, or I've got some stripes on my sleeve and some medals on my chest and you don't, so therefore I'll watch you for the weekend.
Yeah. There's no watching for a weekend, when you do it right in the military. And I do have to, you know, paint an accurate picture. That's the one thing. I don't like to whitewash anything. Not all soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors, they're not all created equal. The one thing that you learn about the military is what you learn about relationships. It's what you learn about anything. What you get out of it is what you put in. So in here's where I want to go with that. I use a little analogy when I talk about commitment in the things that you do. Everything that you want to do is like a dating relationship. And how much commitment do you want to give? Now, when I first went into the military, it was like, you know, like the first date I had with my wife, she was a hot chick. I just wanted to be with the pretty girl. How much commitment do you have involved in that? You know, it's a desire. It's just, you see something you like the flashy thing, and you're going after the flashy thing. But then as the relationship developed and we became more exclusive, I became more committed, more attentive to her needs, whatever. And that's where you start building that bond. You open yourself up and you let yourself be vulnerable, but at the same time, that vulnerability is not a detriment, as long as you don't become, you know, overly emotionally tied. You know, you've got to be one of the team. And then over time, we became married and I made a commitment to her. It became a covenant. It became this give and take where I get more out of it than I give. But you just this total immersion bonding experience, that's just the highlight of a life. If you let yourself follow those same principles with what you do in life, and you get away from the baubles, and it's about the salary and the whatever and the bling and how it looks or whatever, and you let yourself be vulnerable, you let yourself get buy-in, you listen as much as you speak, You give as much as you get. It builds that covenant-like relationship and makes you better at whatever it is, whether it's a cop, whether it's a military person, whether it's a husband, whether it's in a relationship, whether it's being a bodybuilder. That is what sets it apart. That's what makes it worthwhile. And that's where you learn your why. And one of the things I love, I love Simon Sinek. I love anything leadership. I love watching anything on TED. I love it. But I remember the first time I came across Simon, and he was talking about leaders eat last, and you know, he was talking about, you know, finding your why and all that stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, we've been talking about this since the 80s in the military. This is, we've been, and it realized that corporate America was coming around to our philosophy and like our understanding, our way of doing things. And it was also about that same time that the military started embracing a lot of the things that were going on in the civilian sector, you know, to enhance soft skills. So I think this, the synergy of both is really great for developing leaders. You don't have to be a military leader to be in the military, be a good leader. And you don't have all the answers as a military leader. We learn from each other. And it's that constant swirling learning experience that gives you tools for your tool set that help you at different times. Because there's things I've learned in civilian leadership that came into play on deployments abroad, where you would find some thing that you learned about, or some way to engineer a problem, or some soft skill when it comes to dealing with people, or some conflict resolution thing that would come into play at a critical incident that was not taught in the military. But then there's other stuff that I learned in the military that running the OCB with my teammates come into play. So it's all useful, and it is how you apply it, and it's how much commitment you give to something determines how much satisfaction and success you get out of it.
And I think you kind of addressed a key piece, which is having the reason in the first place, which is the why. And without that, that commitment's not going to be there, because you're going to be looking for, I want more money. You know, it's going to become about the money and not about why you're doing it in the first place.
Well, here's the funny thing. When it comes to leading followers, this is something that all leaders can take in. The Gallup poll did studies for decades. There's a book out called Strength-Based Leaders, Leadership. Great book. It's about yay big of a read, and all the rest of it is like exercises. But here is what I got out of it. And this is what I've learned through anything I have ever done and talking to countless people who followed me as a leader, whether it's been in bodybuilding, police, military, it doesn't matter. Followers only have four real needs, that if you meet those leads, you will develop them into leaders as well. And then as leaders, you need to learn what the four aspects of leadership are and to be a well-rounded leader. But I don't believe, personally, this is a Sully, I don't believe there's any such thing as a well-rounded leader. There are well-rounded teams. But here are the four needs of a follower. They want stability. They want stability within an organization and within a leader, okay? Once they find that stability, that gives them that tranquility to move forward. They want hope. They want hope for a future for them. How do you develop your subordinates to be hopeful? You provide them with the direction that they need to improve in whatever the task is, whether it's collecting carts at a grocery store or trying to configure, multi-million-dollar defense contracts, whatever. It doesn't matter. They need hope for their future. So you as a leader need to turn around and provide them with the tools that they need to move forward and let them know, hey, you're here. We need you here. And this is your gap, and here's how we're going to develop it. So you need to provide them with hope. They need compassion. If they're 15 minutes late from work, they don't need for you to yell at them in front of everybody. What they need is compassion. Now, you can't be overly compassionate and get walked on, but at the same time, a compassionate leader is going to turn around and say, hey, come in. Sit down. You're 15 minutes late 3 days this week. Is there a reason why? I want to know, like, what's going on in your life? Tell me. And that's when you find out that there's all these other things going on in their life that's interfering with their work, but they think it's all about work and blah, blah. Well, that's where you as a leader can turn around and give them a little bit of slack. Or you might turn around and say, yeah, I just, I'm just sleeping late all the time. Okay, well, here, the next time this is going to happen and this is going to happen, there's going to, here are your repercussions because you are responsible for your own self. So you got to have that compassion and trust. They need to trust you. Therefore, your word needs to be your bond. You can't make promises you can't keep. And if you do say something, you need to follow through. And if you can't follow through, they need to be brought in to told the why. Hey, yeah, I'm going to get you that raise. I'm going to get you that raise. You're due for it. It shows you end up a boom. And then you can't get on the raise because corporate had a $20 million loss and nobody's getting raises. And a matter of fact, you as the boss is getting a 4% cut in pays. If you bring them in and explain that out to them and you give them the why and you're transparent about it, it's going to increase that trust. And if they trust you, you also need to trust them. You can't micromanage them. That's what another thing that trust means. Trust means that, hey, Ray, here's your task. I need you to complete X, Y, and Z. Here's your suspend state. And you pin a rose on that person and you let them move forward. Now you're going to need to follow up every now and again, but you're trusting them to accomplish the task and not micromanage it. And if they do get from point A to point Z, and they do it in a different way than you would have done it, you can't correct them on that. They found their path. They went from A to Z and they got there. They might have missed a few letters, but they got there. They might have jumbled some things and recorrected. They got there. That's the development. That's the trust. You do those four things and you will have followers that never want to leave an organization, because people don't leave an organization because of the organization. They leave it because of other people and how they're treated. So that's how you build strong organizations. That's how you build strong followers. And that's how you build future teammates. And every leader needs to build a bench. The worst thing I've ever seen is that leader that will not build a bench. And then you turn around and I had to do this as a command chief. I had to have these conversations. Hey, you know what? You're coming up on ETS and we may not retain you. Who are your go-to people? Who's the bench that you built? Well, you can't get rid of me. I'm too valuable. Nobody can do what I do. Well, you've been in that seat for 10 years and nobody can do what you can do. Then you have failed me in the worst possible way, because you have made it all about you and you have developed nobody. And those are the people that you usually remove, and they're throwing a party, not because it's, they're retiring or moving on to the great, it's like, oh, goodness. It's because, hey, thank God you're gone. So those are just some of the tidbits that I learned over the years and that I find very valuable. So yeah, if you meet those four needs of a follower, they're not going to care as much about their salary. They're not going to care as much about, what they're getting out of something, because you're developing them on the inside. You're giving them that, you're giving them that compass, that map. You're showing that commitment to them, and they're going to develop a commitment for themselves and others as well.
And I think you touched on the team component there. And I had a good friend that went through the Marine Corps officer program, and he was an active duty officer for a long time. And he said, basically, like, the way we treat things is we make it as simple as it needs to be, so every soldier understands the mission and they can accomplish it. And left out of that is telling somebody how to go from A to Z. And that's, if you're a good leader and you build a good team, you don't care how they execute. What you care about is that they got to Z. And if they got there, it's all that matters. And if you can't allow yourself to trust them to do that, you're gonna be in a position where you, as the leader, have to do everything.
And leaders always have to, 100% true, and leaders always have to resist the urge to clone other leaders. Now here's where I want to go with that. Human beings have an innate desire to procreate. We want to create other human beings. It's why our species has survived. It's innate in us. But we also want to procreate other people like us and things that we do. We want to make, as bodybuilders, other mini bodybuilders that are like us, as officers like us. We want to procreate, we want to clone, or we want to create other leaders. But you got to be careful not to clone yourself. People need to lead their own way. This is why we need more diversity. And this is something that the military has really, really done, is with that diversity. Because me, as being a white middle-aged male, well, old male now, if I only wanted to create who has a style of leadership, you know, that's ingrained in me, if all I do is want to recreate other white middle-aged males that lead the same way that I lead, we are losing the diversity. We are losing the ability to have new ways of doing that things. We're losing innovation because we're trying to make everybody like us. So leaders need to be very, very careful when they're training and selecting leaders that they're not trying to clone themselves in the way they do things and look at themselves. But they need to be able to go off and like my last 4 or 5 years in the Air Force, I had some really great, great people that I worked with that when they were left with their own devices, they came up with some really, really great solutions. And it didn't matter their age. It didn't matter, you know, gender. None of that stuff mattered, because humans have developed their way of thinking about things and tackling a problem based on their demographic as they grew up. Like the way I grew up, I came up with, you know, ways of problem solving. But somebody that grew up in, you know, the Alaskan wilderness, as opposed to Columbus, Ohio, is going to have a different way of thinking about stuff. Somebody that's 19 is going to have a different way of thinking about and tackling problems the way somebody who's 66. So my whole point is, let them go. Let them go and get there. And don't try to clone them to like your way of thinking, your perspective. Get that diversity built. Get that outside perspective. You'll have greater innovations and a greater end result.
Well, and I think the other thing is like I caution businesses I work with, and even in my own once upon a time organization when I had a brick and mortar business and in-person employees that worked with me on a daily basis, like the last thing you want is to create a team of clones of yourself where what your strength is your strength. And whatever your weaknesses are, you don't need more people that have the same weakness or deficiency as you do, because now you're exposed. What you want is, in my opinion, you want somebody that is strong where you're weak, and you want that to come together kind of like the yin and the yang, you know, in that way your organization is going to be stronger. So you might have somebody that has the great people soft skills. I don't, like mine suck. I'm terrible at that stuff. So I always needed somebody on my team that was strong in those areas so they could offset that.
Exactly. And that's where it comes back into building a team. That's why if you know what your strengths and your weaknesses are, it allows you to develop leadership teams. Now, you may have the title, and many, many times in my military career, I had the title, and it was a sole title. It didn't come with an executive staff. Okay. A lot of positions don't. You don't have an executive staff, but you do have colleagues. You do have subordinates. You do have people that you're developing that can round out your skill set that you can use as if you're not a good influencer. And that's important. You know, like every corporation, everything, no matter what you do, you need to have somebody with a strategic vision. Here's where we're going. You need to have executors. You know, we're going to get the mission done this way. You need to have people that help build buy-in with the collective. And, you know, you also need to have those relationship builders that keep everything going. If you're not a good relationship builder and you got somebody down the hall from the office complex of you that's like Mr. Personality, everybody gravitates to him. You know, he's the guy at the, you know, at the water cooler everybody wants to talk to. If you pull him in and make him part of your leadership team, give them credit where credit is due, give them guidance, give them direct, you are going to get the buy-in of your collective on what you try to do. If that's not your strong point, then don't do it. I remember back when I first started my leadership journey, the military was always, you know, you need to know what your weaknesses are and develop them and develop it. And people would spend so much time trying to develop their weaknesses that were just, you know, ingrained into who they were, that the missions would fall apart or things wouldn't get done and they would lose their strengths. And then when it came to a team array of leadership style and, you know, put your team and develop your team, You know, your team might be one other person. You know, if it's an organization, if you're leading, you know, four people, it might be one other person. If you're leading an organization like, you know, the Massachusetts National Guard, you know, like 7,000 people, you know, you might have 10 or 12 people scattered throughout that complement your team in different areas. So you need to develop those teams accordingly, but you don't do it alone. And as soon as you know, you realize, and you need to be honest for feedback too. You know, you need to be able to have those people that you trust that you can sit there and go, what am I missing? What am I doing wrong? Because they're going to come in. They're going to say, oh, you're great. You're great as a sliced bread. No, don't tell me what they say to my face. Tell me what they say when I'm not in the room. And that will help you develop. But you have to have thick skin because, yeah, might be some ugly babies there.
In that the developing weakness thing, like I do that with clients all the time. And, you know, it's, I'm 5'8". I can't reach the very back of the refrigerator. No matter what I do to resolve that issue, short of grabbing a chair or a step stool, I'm not going to change it. And in business and in a leadership standpoint, like, you should know what your weaknesses are. You should play to your strengths. And then the understanding where you're weak is your opportunity to build that great team around you. You know, go for the refrigerator example, go get the 6'6" person that can reach everything on top of the refrigerator, right? But don't, you know, the idea that you're going to get better at what you're weak at, sure, you can improve, but usually at best, you'll be average. And if you're just average, you're going to get your butt kicked in whatever industry or whatever organization you're in. Like, average won't get the job done.
And what makes average average? Doing the same thing, thinking you know, not knowing what you don't know. What are the four most underused words in leadership? What do you think? The four most underused words. Pulling somebody in and say, what do you think? I think it's stupid. Why? And they can give you some insights, you know, but that's something that happens at, you know, we do that in the military. I mean, people think that, you know, you have, you know, this leader that goes out and says, you know, go forward. That's it. There are so many planning sessions and so many meetings that go on. I mean, my last assignment, I worked with a 2-star general, and her and I were inseparable. We did everything together. Every conversation was that. Now, she was making decisions for the entire Air National Guard for Massachusetts. And there was not a time when it was a critical decision that she would not have her leaders, her advisors, her team in to discuss it. Yet when she goes forward in front of the troops and she, boom, you know, everybody, you know, it appears that you got all the answers, but you don't. And it's okay. And she was also one that if anybody had, hey, my team's right there. No, Sully's right here, you know, talking to me. I need Sully, or I need, you know, so-and-so. You know, I'm not going to name any other names, but, you know, she would have her team there to make difficult decisions. It was always ultimately her decision.
But I think that, like, an effective leader is going to collect data, and that data is going to come from, and I don't like the term subordinate, but most people will recognize that, like, as a leader of an organization, whatever it might be, your data is going to come from the people that you work with. And typically, if you're the leader, they technically work for you or under you, but that's your greatest resource. Like, they're, you know, you looking at the military, if you're in a dress uniform in the office, you have no idea what's going on with the individuals that aren't in their military dress uniform that are in the field. They do. And like you said, what do you think? It doesn't get any easier to collect data than asking that question. I had a new coach trainer that I owned a large commercial gym and training center. And I had weekly training department meetings. And I had a new hire, a trainer, a coach, and he had an idea on how he could do something better. And he was nervous to say it. And the individual that actually ran and oversaw that department, training and coaching, was like, go ahead and tell him. And he's like, no, he's like, seriously, tell Ray, give him your idea. And he did. And I'm like, all right, do it. And he's like, what? I'm like, listen, man, like you're on the floor with the clients. I'm not. If there's a better way to do what we do, we should be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the data, right? Like, you know, and a good leader is going to ask for the data, or at least they should be.
They need the data, but they also need to have the relationships built with their staff and that trust and all those other things, because they might not be forthcoming with the data. They might not give you all the, or they might give you the data that you want to hear because they don't want to get yelled at because it's self-preservation. So you need to build that relationship. Another thing you need to do is you need to walk the halls and listen to people. There's nothing worse than the boss that's, and I had one, oh, one of the things that drove me out of police work was some of the bosses we had there. But we had one that just sat in his ivory tower, and it was serious. I am serious about this. Anytime that he would start walking the building, you would see everybody pumping out all the back doors or like flipping up. Nobody was like, you know, hey, how are you? It was always disappear. Mm-hmm. And if you were ever out there and you got the, you know, hey, so-and-so, you know, report to the chief's office, it was always a sinking feeling of dread and forebrooding. It was never, oh yeah, okay, great. I'm going to have a great conversation. It's going to be a great leadership. No, it was always like, you know, bronze death march, you know, dun, 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 dun. If you are that kind of a leader and you are developing that, you are never going to get good data. If there is success, it's going to be in spite of you. And, you know, all you're doing is you become a speed bump. You become a speed bump. And unfortunately, a lot of times people develop to that point and they have blinders on. And there's no going back. You're not going to change things. So what do you do then? What do you do when your boss is just absolutely horrible? The only thing that you can do is make it better for the people around you and try to keep everything together, keep everything moving forward. Because bosses generally don't last. And even the bad ones, they generally don't last. They don't.
In that trust piece, in the employee that you haven't developed the relationship with, you haven't set the culture, you get the bad data. That's why this new coach or trainer for my organization was reluctant to speak up, because he came from an environment where the quote unquote employees didn't participate in how the organization was run. Like it was the owner's way or the highway. And I eventually, and it took me years to get there, but I arrived at the fact that I certainly didn't know everything. And I had a lot of great people that were a lot better at doing stuff than I was. And most of them were face-to-face, forward-facing with our customers every day, and I wasn't. So if they had an idea, they were probably right.
Yep.
And I encouraged them to say that. And if there was, you know, on the, you know, if there's something we should be doing, let's do it. If there's something we shouldn't be doing, well, then let's not do it.
Exactly. And sometimes we as leaders are so enamored with our own ideas, you know, especially if you have success. And I fell victim to this. You know, I would, you know, go up the chain with an idea, would be a great idea, well received, was this great success. So then I go forward and that would be a great success. So you just think that everything you say is going to be successful. Then you come up with another one that's an utter abject failure. You need to own the failures as well as the successes. Because I'll tell you right now, I've never, ever learned anything about myself with a victory or something going well. I have only learned about myself and developed new skills when things were not going wrong or when something I put forward failed miserably. Because then I learned humility. I learned how to accept a loss and how to come back from it. I learned that failure is not as bad a word as it sounds. I want people to fail, because then you can determine, are you the type of person who fails and quits, or are you the type of person who fails and says, yeah, you know what? That didn't work. I own it. I want another try, coach. Great. Because if you look at great teams, and we'll look at football teams. One of my favorite teams was New England Patriots from back in the early 2000s. Tom Brady threw a pass to a receiver. How many times do you think those receivers caught those passes? 100% of the time? No receiver catches 100%. 50% of the time, maybe a good one. maybe a good one, but you got to keep giving them the opportunity just because they drop the ball. And the good receivers are always going to want the ball. I dropped it. My bad. I ran a bad route. Give it to me again. All right, here you go. And that's how you develop. The bad receiver is going to be, I dropped the ball. And I'm just going to kind of like hide back. I'm not going to, my route's going to suck from now on. I'm just, and they disappear. You never hear from them again.
Yeah. I mean, failure. I've got a diagram I drew years ago and had in my other office. It's hanging here off screen, but it's a staircase and the steps are labeled fail. And at the top of the staircase is success. Like the only way you're going to be successful is if you're willing to make mistakes. And I say, take good notes and then try again.
Exactly. And
the sports analogy is interesting because we don't pay enough attention to that. Like it, and I have no idea what a receiver catches, but you have to figure that even a good receiver drops about half of the balls.
Probably about
so
that. Yeah.
You have to be willing to get back out there and go again. Because if you are the recipient of 100 passes, there's probably 50 of them that are hitting the turf.
Yep. And we all know people in our organizations that end up in a spot and they're there forever. They never move on. They never go beyond. They're generally the people that are a little toxic. They complain about the people who get promoted to the next rank, especially if they're newcomers or whatever. They just kind of like sit there in their middle bubble, never going any further, never advancing, totally disgruntled, whatever. Sometimes when you peel that onion back, you find out it's because they weren't properly mentored. It's because they weren't properly. But a lot of times you find it's because they're afraid to fail. They have analysis paralysis. They look at everything. I'm like, you know, nope, nope, nope. I'm afraid. But so they make fun of everybody who tries for that tough assignment. They make fun of everybody who goes for that promotion. They make fun of everybody who puts in that extra mile. It's like, you know, what are you doing that crap for? You know, what are you doing? You know the type. Those are people that have learned not to try for fear of failure. They're not people that embrace failure. I embrace failure. When I was a SWAT team commander and we would do training exercises or even on call outs, it's more stressful. But in trainings, we'd come up with this great training plan and I would be in the tactical operations center, you know, getting ready to manage my teams. And you got, you know, get your snipers here and your assault team here, whatever. And somebody come running in like, hey, Lieutenant Sullivan, mission spoobar. Here's, you know, we can't get in through that door or something. And then all my people used to tell me the same thing. I'd get a little grin on my face and go, good, good. I wanted the mission messed up because everybody out there would start thinking on their own and coming up with it. I loved it when a plan didn't totally fall into place. That was always my mojo because it was like, and sometimes we'd end up with a successful ending. Sometimes not so successful, but we always learned from it. We always learned from it. And it gave me the opportunity to look at my people that were working with me, my other leaders that also had that mindset. And now that I'm, I don't know, 6, 7 years moved on from the police department, you know, all those team leaders have now moved in to be sergeants and lieutenants within the organization. One's a SWAT team commander, you know, so they're all leaders in what they're doing because they learned, they adopted that. They didn't, you know, we didn't like perfect plans that went perfectly. We liked chaos.
In that, you know, that's the mark of a good leader. And I think it's talked about in the book, Good to Great. And yep. I think it would fall into the level 5 leader for those that have read that book. And I think tying that back to you have to build your bench. One of the shortcomings I see in organizations is especially small privately held businesses, in most often family owned businesses, the bench has never been developed. So there's not a qualified successor to the person at the top of the pyramid. So that person can't hand the business to the son or the daughter because they haven't developed them. They're not good enough leaders. And to speak to your ability to effectively lead people, if you're 7 years removed and people that were on your teams that you led are now moving up, clearly you built your bench. You developed the next generation of leaders to backfill positions that are vacated, and you know, in your case, you retired. And that's a huge missed opportunity that I see with businesses, is they don't go and develop other people.
Exactly. And the smart ones that progress and expand do. And I'm going to go into the OCB right now. So for the OCB, for those who listen who are not bodybuilders, it's the Organization of Competitive Bodies, and been around for 20 years. It was started by Matt Shepley, 21, going on 21 years ago now. Started with him. I happened to be there for ground zero. You know, it was he and I doing a lot of discussion and talking. We met a few years after that, Ray, you know, got you on board, and we just kind of like whatever. But Matt was smart enough to know that he had to have a supporting cast. And that's where, you know, Chad came in and Marjorie and myself, whatever. And so he had a supporting cast of people that helped mentor him and help navigate the Federation through. And we started having talks about five years ago. I would be on my drives back and forth, because I, at the time, I was living in Virginia, but my leadership assignment was in Massachusetts. So I'm driving back and forth all the time. He'd call me a lot. And we would talk about leadership and all the stuff that we talked about. You know, what does a leadership need? Well, you need to have a strategic, you know, somebody with a strategic mind. You need to have somebody who can execute stuff. You need to have a relationship builder. You need to have somebody who's an influencer who can get outside of it. And we'd be talking about all this stuff. I never knew at the time that he was looking at the people he had surrounded himself with to see who is best at this attribute, who is best at that attribute. How can they work together? Who can I put together as a team to take over this entity that is now getting to the point that it cannot be a sole proprietary company? It has to have a leadership foundation and team. And that was one of the things that he did when he put the leadership team together. It wasn't, you know, four muscle heads who had success, or it wasn't, you know, four goombas that, hey, I'm going to hand them off to you. He strategically thought about who is the strategic visionary of the team, who is the influencer, who is the executor. Now, we all do those tasks, you know, we can all, you know, fill in, but we're stronger together. And that's why the OCB has had unparalleled growth since COVID. Since COVID, we have been growing at an incredible rate, where everybody else retracted, where everybody else is stumbling, trying to find their, you know, their. Why? Because of the team, because of the leadership team. You can't replace that. You can't replace what he put together and handed it over to, and how you move forward. And that's how a successful organization needs to move forward. Everybody, you know, like we married into a family, but everybody knows when to go to a Sully for something. Everybody knows when to go to a Chad for something. Everybody knows when we're going to Marjorie or a Frank for something, because they know our strengths and our weaknesses. And we know too, and that's how we rely on each other. So that's how you move forward as a business, as an entity. You build that team. You build it based on their strengths, and you figure out where their gaps and weaknesses are and who can fill in. And then you put that team together. And then, you know, after a short storming phase, you know, we had a norming phase, and we were forming, and we're executing. And that's what businesses need to do.
And again, that team, building a team and not trying to clone yourself back to the refrigerator. You know, if you have to get something off the top of the refrigerator and you don't have a 6-footer, you're going to have to go move furniture, or you could just put a 6-footer on your team and it's handled. And that's, you know, that's the beauty in building a team. Even tying back OCB, I promote two bodybuilding contests through the OCB, and we had one a couple weeks ago, and I had a 2B OCB promoter shadow me. And she was mind blown that I wasn't running around with my hair on fire, freaking out and stressed out or anything. And I kept reminding her, and I'm like, look around, like everything is getting done. Like, my job is to be the guy with the spreadsheet, and then be the guy that builds a team of people that are dislike me, that they have strengths I don't. And then we just say, here's, you know, here's the strategic vision on the spreadsheet. Here's the list of things to be accomplished. Now the teams execute. How they execute them, it doesn't matter to me. Like, I'm not going to get hung up in the minutia. I don't need to micromanage.
Right.
And she was kind of like, well, this is crazy. And I'm like, well, no, it's simple. Like, I can't do this by myself. Like, my job is to have the idea and then build a great team.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's true of every endeavor. Every endeavor. I mean, it's true of relationships too. It's true. Yeah. Relationship. Why do relationships fail? Why do relationships fail? Because you don't have a teammate. You don't have somebody that, you know, like, yeah, you can bicker, you can disagree, but the trust is always got to be there. If you have a teammate, your relationship's not going to fail. But people are not willing to develop teammates, not willing to share. They're not willing to, you know, to bond and to humanize, even in relationships. It becomes a competition. Relationships that become a competition, you know, nope, I'm in touch. Nope, me, nope, dip, doomed for failure. Relationships where you build a teammate will always be successful.
Yep.
Same is true with businesses. Same is true with organizations. Same is true with anything that you do.
Now, you had said the last time we spoke too, like, the military was good at identifying individuals that may have certain strengths.
Yep.
And to move them in a position to kind of exploit those strengths. Have you seen that in a private sector where there's kind of a plan to be aware of that? Or is that something that really exists more in the military and is maybe something the private sector could steal and copy more of?
It's something I think that the private sector needs to steal and copy more of. Now, I am not as in tune with a lot of, you know, the operations of major corporations. I do have friends that are involved, you know, at various levels of management in, you know, big businesses. The ones that are really clicking and doing it good, the ones that everybody wants to go work for now, are the ones that have that model down. The businesses that you see and you hear about that shed people, that, you know, that appear, if there's an appearance of dysfunction, then they're dysfunctional. And I have I am friends with so many small business owners where I live here. I'm in the middle of nowhere, Virginia, which is exactly where I want to be, by the way. You know, but one of my favorite businesses out here is a little coffee shop, just a little coffee shop. I love going there because the people who work there love working there. They absolutely adore their boss. They're treated like anything that you can come up with or define as a successful way to run a business, they are doing there. And the place is a gold mine. I used to be able to go in and only wait a second for a cup of coffee. Now I go in and sometimes I got to wait 10 minutes, but they've developed something great there. Absolutely great. And then there are other situations where I have had people come to work on my house, you know, where they'll have a, you know, a company that employs 15 or 20 or 30 people working for this particular corporation. And they come, and every time they come, it's different people. You know what happened to somebody? He quit. Oh, the foreman quit. Oh, this quit. It's constant dysfunction. They barely get the job done, generally not to my satisfaction, definitely not to my wife's satisfaction. And then we have to go to another company. And then we have the new company come in, and it's just like the coffee place. They love their boss. Everybody's been there for 20 years. So the ones that get it, and they're thriving. And the ones that don't are existing. And that's the difference between thriving and existing. If you want to thrive, you know, then you got to jive. You got to get in. You've got to, you know, you got to, you know, open it up. You got to build that bench. You got to, you know your why. You have to have your own core values that your people can respect and emulate. You have to turn around and give people, you know, opportunity. You do all those things, and you're going to be like my favorite coffee place and, you know, my new favorite contractor doing work on my house. You're going to have businesses that thrive.
In that small coffee shop, it's not, obviously it's not Starbucks, right?
Nope.
So they're not a large publicly traded corporation that has layers of management with it layers of bureaucracy. They don't have significant dollars and cents to invest. They don't have corporate handed down, proven, validated operating systems. Yet there they are. They're successful. And it probably wasn't a huge investment. I don't believe I know nothing of this business, but I'm gonna guess the owners didn't invest tens of thousands of dollars into each employee in an attempt to make them happy. Instead, they probably just looked at, kind of like you said, the four pillars or four things, you know, stability, hope, compassion, and trust. Those are free items.
Yep.
Like that doesn't cost you money. And then they probably, well, Sully comes here and gets coffee. How can we make him happy as a customer? That's it.
Yeah. It's as simple as that. As simple as that. Some people focus so much on the needs of their customers that they forget the needs of their employees. You know, but there's an absolute synergy to that. You know, I see so much focus on customer satisfaction, and you know, we all see the videos. Some customers can be just downright awful, awful, awful people. But everything is based on, you know, the customer. Well, when you look at it as a yin and a yang, and it's the customer and the employee, and for every little bit of customer, there's employee, and for every little bit of employee, there's a little customer. Think of it as a yin-yang symbol, and that adds that continuity to it. That's going to just like bring it all together and add clarity and focus. Because if you're focused on your customers at the expense of your employees, you're not going to have a business. And if you're focused only on your employees at the expense of your customers, you're not going to have a business. When you can balance and you can do both, you're going to thrive.
So I did one of these webcast podcasts with the owner of almost 100-year-old business. It's packaged food. So it's a manufacturing business that supplies the food industry. Hundreds of employees. So I say hundreds of employees because I can't give you the annual revenue numbers, which I know at the time that I spoke to them. They are staggering, significant, huge. Kind of like I had said, the reason I'm doing these is I know people that might not have a last name of Musk or Bezos, but they've been uber successful at what they do. And this individual is one of them. And he took upon himself as a CEO and said, I'm going to serve my employees. I'm going to put that first. And I'm going to make an investment in them. And stuff that most business owners and CEOs would say, I will not waste my money on that. Well, he did and has enjoyed double digit growth for over 10 years. This is, so again, I said hundreds of employees. This is, you know, a significant size operation, and he shifted the corporate focus to building happy employees. And what happened is the employees love working there. The employees are more productive. The employees make less mistakes. The quality has got, like, everything improved. In his case, he did make meager investments in everybody. Right down to, he has something called a dream coach. Every employee can have a dream coach for a year at no cost. And they will want. It could be go get a degree, get a master's degree, and get a job in a completely different field. He doesn't care. He's like, if I make the investment, the company wins all day. And it's crazy.
That is so true. That is a huge success. One of the things that I always fall back on is the story of Apple and the difference between a short-lived successful company that peters out and a company that invests in its employees and looks at innovation and listens and goes from there. Now, when Apple first came out, that was a niche. It was a niche thing. You know, like here's your computer thing. Here's a niche. You can come up with 100 businesses. You know, they make a widget and everybody needs this widget. Then after everybody buys the widget, the company kind of fans out and goes away. But what made Apple so successful and why we have everything from, you know, their phones to their computers to the this to the that to the other is that they invested in their employees. They listened to their employees. They empowered their employees. And they let their employees innovate. And then they came up with the next thing, and then the next thing, and the next thing, and then, and it just goes from there. Now, are they the same type of business? Yeah, they're into, you know, an electronics. They're an electronics business, but they listened and they diversified. They didn't just come up with a widget like a TiVo, which I personally thought was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I loved TiVo. That went nowhere, went absolutely nowhere. You know, and Simon Sinek has a good TED talk on why TiVo failed and why other things that, you know, that's worth a listen to. But it's all about that investment, that empowerment, that, you know, that trusting, that it's all about that. And that's what, as companies thrive and diversify and whatever, and not be a one-trick pony. Hey, I invented a widget, I made $1 million, and then the company 2 years later folded and went bankrupt. A lot of
Well, and
that.
if you have one innovator, or you have the manager, the boss, the CEO, the president, the owner, whatever label we apply, and they do the innovation, you have one innovator. But if you have an organization with dozens of employees or hundreds of employees, or in the case of Apple, thousands, if you create an opportunity for people to share their idea for innovation, now you have more than one person in charge of innovating. And that's going to prevent you from being that one trick pony.
And you have to be able to listen to all the voices. One of my favorite stories, the story of the P51 Mustang. Now, some of your listeners may know what a P51 Mustang is. A lot of people won't, but a P51 Mustang was probably the greatest fighter of World War II. It basically won the war in Europe as well as the Pacific. Greatest fighter in history. But it didn't start off as the greatest fighter in history. As a matter of fact, it was a colossal flop. It was underpowered, it was not a good dogfighter. Getting ready to get rid of it. It was just going to be just another one of those, you know, great ideas that didn't pan out. A couple of mechanics, a British guy and an American guy, came up with an idea. But now mechanics, we're talking low ranking. We're talking like junior enlisted people, came up with an idea and they said, you know what? I bet a Rolls-Royce Allison engine like we have in the Spitfire would fit in this thing, give it a lot more power. Let's check it out. So they went to their boss, who was probably a captain, and said, hey, can we try this? And the captain empowered him and said the same thing and worked it up the chain of command. And they said, yeah, we need to do something. Bottom line, it worked and turned into the greatest fighter in history. Those were two low-ranking enlisted members that came up with an idea. They weren't even pilots. They weren't even the one piloting the aircraft, let alone the guy who's coming up with a strategic vision of how we're going to win the war. But they were empowered. And they changed the course of the war. This is why our bomber fleet went from, you know, almost, you know, 80% attrition rate and slowly dropped because they could keep the enemy fighters off the bombers and all that. But anyway, the story of the P-51 Mustang is always one of my favorites because, like I said, innovation from two junior enlisted mechanics weren't even pilots, and they figured it out and they went forward.
And that, you know, again, like I used to call it walk and talk, even when I was an engineer working in manufacturing, walk and talk. Like my own organization with my employees, I would be like, let's walk and talk. And it's the ground floor people, the people in the dirt, the people on the shop floor, the people in the hangar servicing the aircraft, they're there looking at it every single day. And sometimes they're probably looking at it saying, you know, it's really dumb the way this is done. And this would work equally well. And if you create an organization where it's okay for them to say that, well, your opportunities to get better and better are almost endless. But the brass, the military black brass, as it was in charge of steering the strategy for the war, they're not out there looking at the aircraft. They're not looking at this Spitfire saying, you know what, this Rolls engine would fit in this other aircraft with minimal work. They would have no idea. They probably would have no idea on what power plant, what engine was in each aircraft. They just knew we have these aircraft. This is what they do. That's it.
They knew the big picture. We're losing the air war. People aren't coming back. We're losing lives. They knew the more myopic view of the pilots saying, this thing sucks. It's underpowered. But what they really knew was engines. They knew space, mechanics, but how to make things work, put it all together, bang. But that also falls in line with the philosophy of making sure that people in your organization understand your direction. They need to understand your intent. They need to understand your direction. They know, like, walk in any company and ask any employee, hey, what does your business stand for? What are you about? And if they go, hey, I just work here, and they walk away,
hell,
cringeworthy, cringeworthy. But when they can turn around and they go, hey, I'm part of X, and we do, hey, I work for, you know, for Cumberland Coffee, and we have one of the best coffee places. We're just so cute, and we do this, we do that, and we make our, oh, and we have all these things, and we do, and they get excited about what they do for you, you're going to go. So, and I say it all the time, my favorite coffee place, Starbucks could open right across the street from it, and Starbucks would be successful. But that coffee place would not only not lose a beat, skip a beat, it would probably gain momentum, because as more people drive out of the way to go to Starbucks, somebody would turn around and say, hey, you got to try across the street. You got to go across the street. Both would be successful.
Right.
Both would, but you know, and that's another thing that comes into coexistence. You know, you got to be able to coexist with your, adversaries. The one thing, in bodybuilding, I see it. We don't do it in the OCB, but in bodybuilding, I see it. Like, each federation is out to try to kill and cripple and destroy the other federation. And we're better because of this, and we're better because of that. You know, like, when we message in the OCB, we just message, this is what we do differently. However, and I say it on my podcast all the time, and I tell everybody, we want other federations to exist, just like the way we want other fast food restaurants to exist, or other choices besides Coca-Cola for soda. Because sometimes I feel like a Coke, sometimes I want a Mountain Dew. There's other days I want an Orange Crush. The same is true for, you know, fast food. Sometimes I want to go to, well, I don't eat a lot of fast food, but sometimes I want to go to Cheesecake Factory, and sometimes I want to go to Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A, but if you look at these companies, they all work together. McDonald's doesn't get torqued because Burger King opens up down the street, and they both are successful, because you can't get a Big Mac at Burger King, and you can't get a Whopper at McDonald's. And sometimes you want a Whopper, and sometimes you want a Big Mac. So as long as you're innovative in your process and what you do, and you distinguish yourself for your own, like, attributes, people will come to you. But just because they come to you doesn't mean they can't go to anybody else too.
Well, and there's contrary to what we think is entrepreneurs and business owners, there is enough business to go around if you're good at what you do. And having competition, like, I used to say this with my gym, like, the best thing that could happen would people come into my facility and say, well, you're $5 more than XYZ facility. The best thing that could happen was they went and got the $5 less expensive experience, because they would be back.
Yeah.
And they would be like, this is worth every penny it costs more to be here. So there's value in that, you know. There's value in having competition. There is enough business for everybody if you're doing a good job and taking care of your people and your customers. But there's also, you know, there's competitive advantage to having a competitor. Like, go have the other experience.
Yep.
Like, go enjoy, go get it for cheap. And then we'll see in a couple months.
Yeah, you don't have to be adversarial with your competition. You don't need to embrace them and market for them. But at the same time, you don't need to be, you know, adversarial. Like you said, you know, you just put out what you offer that's different. And if somebody wants it, they want it. If somebody doesn't, they don't. It's all good. It's all good. As long as you're trying to make what you do better, you know, you're listening to your people, you're innovating, you're listening to your customers, and you're trying to, you know, trying to give it, and you care. That's the other thing. You know, you got to care about what you do. You know, everything I've done has never been a job. It's been just a calling. I swear, my, you know, ever since I got out of high school and I embarked on my different careers, I've never really had a job, you know, because it's never felt like a, you know, like a job. You know, running the OCB with my teammates does not feel like a job to me. Having been, you know, in the military at all levels of leadership has never felt like a job. I mean, now, were there bad days? Oh yeah. There were days where, I'd come home and go, "This sucked." Well, you can have sucky days. You just can't have a sucky attitude.
No, and that's, the when it feels like a job, and this is an often missed point, you're never going to be great at something you're not passionate about, because you won't do all the extra work it takes to become great. And if it's starting to feel like a job, that's why I got out of the gym business. I had three times in the last 18 months that I owned the gym that it felt like a job and I didn't want to go to work. And that's when I realized, I am the secret sauce. I am so passionate about doing this and doing it well that I'll do whatever it takes. And that went away. And you're like, I tell people this, like, you're not, if you're really not into it, you're not, you might be good at it, but you're not going to be great at it. And if you look at, there's all the memes of what businesses were started in garages. There's all the memes of what businesses the owners slept on the couch in the office for 2 years. Like, those are the things, the extra things that people that become really, really good and then become great are willing to do. And if that's not you, you should probably have some self-reflection time and look at what it is you're doing and what you really should be doing.
Absolutely.
And that's, and I think that's probably one of the reasons you've been so successful is, and it goes back to what you said early on, like, you didn't do the things for the money, right?
No.
Like, in the fact that you've never looked at it as a job, I guarantee you that because you didn't look at it as a job when you were in charge of the SWAT team, if you had to come in early, stay late, got a phone call at midnight, you showed up and you weren't like, like, the job, I hate this, whatever. Like, you went because it wasn't work. It was something you wanted to do and do well. If it's not what you're meant to be doing, you're probably not gonna, you're not gonna do the things you need to be great, period.
Exactly.
Just like bodybuilding. I mean, you know this better than I do. I've competed like a dozen times. You're not going to be a great bodybuilder if you're not really passionate about doing it. You're just not. Like, you're going to have an extra bite of food. You're going to hit the jar of peanut butter or whatever it might be. So, what would you say you're like, we always finish out the top three do's and don'ts. What do you think, just quick top three do's for an effective leader? What would your top three must do's be?
Do what's right, because you'll always know what the right thing to do is. So do what's right. Always do everything to the best of your ability with the time that you're given to do it. And show your people that you care.
What are your don't do's?
Do not interfere with a process, even if it's going to lead to somebody failing, because they'll need to learn from failure. How does a diamond develop? A diamond develops, starts off as a lump of coal. And it's developed under intense pressure over a long period of time. Be there to guide and assist your people, but don't pick up the ball for them. And if they're going to fail, allow them to fail gracefully. Never, ever forget, as a leader, it ain't about you. Leaders who make it about them fail. Don't make it about you.
Cool. Well, I think that's good, man. Anything else you'd want to add?
No, sir. I mean, it was a pleasure talking. I'm so used to lately talking about either it's all military slanted or it's all bodybuilding slanted. So, opening this up to a perspective for anybody to understand, this was great. I appreciate it, and thank you
Yeah,
for your
for
time.
sure. And I look at people with your background, although you've got both. Folks in the law enforcement community and then folks in the military community, oftentimes they see themselves like, but they're like, what am I going to do? This is all I've done. And they feel extremely typecast. And I always point back to it and I'm like, listen, like, as a small business owner, you got everything I'm looking for. You've got some of the best leadership training under the sun. You didn't necessarily work in dollars and cents. Like, you dealt in human capital. Like, you're like, you can parlay all of that experience into many other industries.
Yeah, and that's where you need to realize that when you're developing these skill sets, it's not your identity. You're developing a wide variety of skill sets that can be utilized in a lot of other areas. You know, like I don't miss police work. It was great. I love some aspects about it, but I mean, it wasn't my identity. Military, you know, yeah. I've officially been retired now for 4 days. There's no loss of sense. There's no loss of, you know, I feel no loss. I feel like I only had gain because I wasn't command chief. I was Sean Sullivan. And everything I used, everything I learned, everything I developed is still within me. Now I can just project it onto something else. You know, you are not what you do, but what you do can make a better you.
Yeah. And in career wise, 100% that those things can allow you to be a better version of yourself. But in your case, if anybody said, okay, if you go get 30 years experience in the military, 20 years experience as a police officer, you could be an effective owner, operator, leader in a bodybuilding organization. Like that's huge disconnect. Maybe private security, maybe security training, maybe weapons training, maybe, but military, law enforcement, bodybuilding. Like you wouldn't see that comes together, but those skills are applicable in many other industries.
Exactly.
Well, cool, man. I think we'll wrap up. If you like our content, be sure to subscribe to our channel. Leave us a comment below. Also, be sure to check us out on your favorite podcast provider. See the links in the description below.